It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. We're glad you're here today for Friday, March 29th, the last Friday of the month. April is almost here. Later on in the program, some new neighborhood leaders in Lansing will join us on the program. We're gonna go to the grassroots level here in the city and find out what their challenges are. I'm led to believe that these three folks have all risen to the top of their neighborhood organizations just in the matter of the last few weeks or months. So they're kind of new to their positions in a way. So we'll find out what it is they're contending with on the grassroots level in the old Oakland neighborhood, the Westside Commercial Association, and a few others. Also, the Detroit Free Press's Joe Rexroad makes his picks on the MSU and U of M games, both tonight as Sweet 16 action kicks off. But first, it was an eventful month in Michigan and the city of Lansing.
Well, at this point, I don't know where we're going to come up with $1 million out of the police budget.
I think we all want to have more money go to higher education, and we also want to be able to hold down tuition.
We've got this bill dropped that would cut 15% of any university that didn't meet their funding formula for employee contract funding.
Really, as an educator, I'm very concerned about the fact that we are now launching into a reform model that has absolutely no track record whatsoever.
I'm delighted that we're in the hunt, and I think that we're favored because of our workforce, because of the investment that GM has made here.
Certainly with Carl's retirement, I've been approached by many, many people.
Dawson out to Harris for a three ball. He got it!
And to revisit March's biggest news stories in Michigan and the Lansing area, we welcome to Current State the Gongwer News Service's John Lindstrom. Welcome, John.
Mark.
Lindsay Van Holly covers the capital city and environs for the Lansing State Journal. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi.
And Tim Martin covers state government for MLive. How are you, Tim?
Good.
The centerpiece of Michigan news, certainly last week, if not for the month, was likely the announcement of Washington, D.C. Attorney Kevin Orr as the city of Detroit's emergency manager. He actually began his gig this past Monday. I'm curious what you think lay ahead for Mr. Orr and Detroiters. John Lindstrom, a lot of people are braced for a stormy process. What are you inclined to think?
It's going to be extremely difficult. It's been difficult in any situation where you've had an emergency manager. Obviously, the city's finances are in bad shape. They've been in bad shape for quite some time. The economic recession didn't help, and of course, the demographic situations that the city's going through doesn't help either. So from the financial standpoint, you're going to start off with, you're going to see Kevin Orr obviously try to find ways of controlling costs, shifting costs if need be, and also try to raise revenue if through no other means, through the fact that the city has done such a poor job of collecting taxes to start with. They're going to have to try to find a way of improving on that record. Nearly half of the property taxes that the city is owed are not collected on an annual basis. So they're going to have to find a way of trying to turn that around. Just collecting that money alone would make a big difference to the city's finances. But you're going to see a number of things going to have to happen. I would not be surprised to see one of the first things that's happened, outside of the fact that Kevin Orr has already said he's not cutting the salaries of the mayor and the council, which he would have the authority to do under the new act that took effect yesterday. But I think one of the things you keep an eye out for is what's going to happen with Belle Isle, which, as you know, the state offered to make that basically a state park, and the city council rejected that.
That will be revisited, do you think?
I think it'll be revisited because, if nothing else, that will take about $5 million off of the city's ongoing budget requirements.
Yeah.
And this is the sort of thing where you look for every nickel and dime you can. So
whether restructuring or a bankruptcy filing happens seems to also be a part of this discussion.
Well, that's certainly going to be a long-term thing. When he was announced, Kevin Orr said at the press conference, "Don't make me go to bankruptcy." So in effect, he's throwing out, saying, find a way to work so that we can get this to go. Of course, we did have yesterday a lawsuit filed, not only on behalf of Detroit, but all the cities that are in emergency management situations. So we'll have to see what happens with that, whether or not the law is upheld.
Tim Martin, what's your take?
Well, the numbers that they're dealing with in Detroit are just scary. I mean, I'd be nervous if I was taking Kevin Orr's job. He's got $327 million budget deficit, $14 billion in long-term debt. You have a population that's declined 25%, I think, in the last decade, and by more than half over the last few decades. So you lose a lot of your tax base there. It's just, it is going to be a tough job, and I think, as John mentioned, an important one was kind of offering that olive branch early on by not cutting Mayor Bing's salary or the city council's
pretty
salary.
Symbolic right. Move there.
Yeah, I thought it was very important because if Detroit's ever going to get out of the mess that it's in, they are going to need some folks all pulling together in the same direction, and that's been a problem in the city for years.
And I gather there's a consensus that a bankruptcy filing is to be avoided, if at all possible, and that letting Mr. Orr negotiate a restructuring is much preferable to a bankruptcy.
You certainly would prefer not to go through a Chapter 9 situation. Stockton, California, right now is the largest city that is going through that. And you don't want to top that and become now the largest city that ever have to go through that. It doesn't do anything good for the state in terms of its financial situation if your largest city is in bankruptcy. So that's a factor that obviously you would want to avoid. But you also have to hold that out as an option. And some people have said, you know, you look at General Motors, Chrysler, some large corporations that did go through structured bankruptcies and were able to restructure themselves and pull out. Maybe in the long term, that's what you need to do. One of the advantages you can do with that is restructure some of your long-term debt, which is a problem that all municipalities and all public entities are going through now because of changes in GASB rules and things like that.
Doesn't it also, though, theoretically put more authority into the hands of a bankruptcy judge?
Well, yeah, but I mean,
it concentrates authority into fewer hands.
In effect, you would give. One of the things you have to remember is when Governor Snyder came up with the emergency manager idea, one of the things he was trying to do was, in effect, give an emergency manager the same authority that a bankruptcy judge has. And that was the whole idea. And so Kevin Orr, to a certain degree, has the authority that a bankruptcy judge would have. Not completely, and there are limits. And under the law that took effect yesterday, there's some additional limits as well from, say, PA4, which the public voted down. But the emergency manager has significant amounts of control and authority legally.
Okay.
Presuming the courts don't throw it out. And if it were to go to bankruptcy judge, it would just be one fraction more authority on the part of the bankruptcy judge.
Okay. Let's go local here regarding municipal revenue for a few minutes. Lansing's closely watched financial health team released its long-awaited report this month. It was months in the making. There were pages of pretty aggressive recommendations to come to terms with Lansing's ongoing structural deficits. It's a lot of red ink stretching into the future, like a lot of cities. Lindsay Van Holly, could you revisit a few of the key recommendations in that report?
Sure. They started off really looking at three different areas. You know, short term, what can be done immediately in the budget coming up for the next year? What can be done over the longer term? Things like contract negotiations, controlling pension and health care costs are really the big piece of that. And the last one is sort of a regional approach. What can we do to sort of combine services with other local governments? The fire study that's ongoing with Lansing and East Lansing and a few townships is one example of that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they ranged from, you know, selling City Hall and finding a joint headquarters with the school district, taking a look at streetlight fees and hydrant fees,
right,
with BWL, which actually was the largest line item at about $5.5 million,
right,
and really shifting that out of the general fund and into the hands of the users.
What kind of response did this report get?
It's certainly bold, and that's what, you know, Mayor Bernero had said from the beginning. You know, put everything on the table and have that be, kind of your vision for what is coming next. I think it certainly got that response. There are a lot of things in there that are going to take a lot of work and a lot of review really to do.
And Mayor Bernero followed up with his budget last week. Did that document include a lot of these financial health team recommendations, or did he sidestep it for some reason?
The major one that's in there, the streetlight fees, actually did make it, and that alone can actually close out the deficit now. The city had been projecting about $9 million deficit, and had actually since has been reduced to about $5 million.
Right.
$2 million more than projected in property tax revenue collection, and about $2 million less than in healthcare costs.
But it's $46
a year.
A year additional for BWL customers. Is that going to get some resistance? I mean, Carol Wood was here the morning after the budget was announced. You know, she wasn't really eager to get on board with that and pass those costs on to BWL customers. How big of an issue is that going to be?
You know, it certainly has the potential. There's a lot of, you know, I can see a lot of resistance happening in the sense that, you know, people pay property taxes. You know, the argument being that we pay for a lot of these services already. But the challenge is that, you know, as property tax, you know, property values go down, the amount of money you take in revenue also goes down. So
right.
it's sort of a balance act that's going to have to be worked out.
The financial team's recommendations included a $2 million haircut for the fire department and a $1 million cut for the police. Here is Lansing's police union executive Tom Krug responding to that last week here on Current State.
I think part of the study brought out some good points that they need to make part of the city, the cemeteries, the golf courses, and so forth, self-sufficient. But as far as the police department, they've lost 65 positions in the last few years that they haven't filled. They're at their all-time low as far as staffing. And we feel the staffing can't go any lower than it is now. And at this point, we don't see where we can come up with $1 million.
That's Tom Krug of the Fraternal Order of the Police in Lansing. Lindsay, any thoughts on who's got the leverage in this discussion? Is it the administration or is it the unions?
You know, they both certainly have a position, and it's going to be, sort of interesting to watch how it plays out. You know, they have said that they're not interested in opening the contract. It expires in 2015. They have that they've been working under.
Mm-hmm.
One of the challenges is going to be the city has been setting aside some money in order to be able to fund some police officers who are basically grant-funded right now.
Right.
And that grant expires next year. And so the mayor's position has been that, you know, if we can control some of these legacy costs, we'll be able to, set more money aside and sort of protect the jobs.
Keep those police.
Right.
Yeah. Tim Martin and John Lindstrom, how are these disputes playing out around the state? Any thoughts on that? Is there a pattern here? How much pressure are municipal unions feeling?
Well, clearly they're feeling a lot. And you've seen this now ongoing for quite some time. And I just want to say about the plan that former Mayor Hollister came up with, you really would be hard-pressed to find anyone better at coming up with the concept of adopting and adapting than Dave Hollister. He did it in the legislature. He did it when he was mayor here in the city. He understands that people want the services that they both need and have always wanted. And the traditional ways of paying for those services are getting really, really stretched. So, you know, since everything is now a marketable commodity, doesn't matter what it is, from trash to city halls, find a way of turning that into revenue for the city. That does mean, however, that the people who are on the line doing the actual work, who obviously got to focus on the jobs that they're doing, it puts them under new pressure because they still got to do the job they've been doing. Understanding that there's going to have to be a new way of adopting and adapting to how to pay for those things. And that's a stress that everywhere across the state they're going through.
Tension between universities and school districts and the state grew last week when Republican lawmakers advanced a bill that would cut state funding by 15% to any school that negotiated a new long-term contract with teachers that did not cut at least 10% of its budget. This mostly affected Wayne State University and the University of Michigan. Now, State Rep Sam Singh first announced and seriously criticized this development here on Current State early last week. The next day, here's how Republican Representative Al Pasholka ended up defending the move. He is recounting his hearings with Wayne State administrators before his subcommittee.
In the hearing, we asked Wayne State point blank, what are the savings to taxpayers? They made some statement about possibly $10 million in health care costs, but you've got an 8-year contract with a $1,000 signing bonus and a 20% pay increase. There is $0 saved for taxpayers.
Tim Martin, where does this legislation stand right now?
Well, right now, these particular proposals have only moved one step. Basically, they've come out of a House Appropriations Subcommittee. So they've got a lot of steps for this thing to actually become a reality, if it ever does become a reality. The next step would be it goes to the House Appropriations Committee, and then it'd have to be approved on the House floor, on the Senate floor, and signed by the governor to happen. So in my mind, anyway, it's kind of an open question as to how this proposal will look by the time it's all done. Will universities like Wayne State or U of M be punished at all, or will they kind of dial down that 15% to a lower number?
John Lindstrom?
Well, the governor has been cautious in talking about this. The Senate has been cautious about talking about this. The universities, of course, have a constitutional protection in terms of their overall authority. There's obviously, and you could just hear it in the tone of Representative Shulka's voice, there's a lot of bitterness on the part of the supporters of right to work that people tried to negotiate contracts before the law took effect. There was another radio commentator today we happened to hear talked about backroom deals. Well, if that was a backroom deal, I suppose anybody purchasing property is involved in a backroom deal. But what was very interesting was that yesterday all of the supporters of right to work were alarmed when Kroger announced that they had come up with a contract with their union, and they just could tell that they felt betrayed by that as well. We'll see what happens with this. I mean, clearly the law existed as the law existed, and people took advantage of the law. And it's a little strange to turn around now and say, well, you're going to punish them for it. But this, I think. I wouldn't be surprised to see something happen to express the Republican legislators' discontent. I don't think it's going to necessarily be 15%.
Not this intense. Okay. Lindsay, can you update us on what happened in the Lansing School District here? There was a new contract hammered out there too.
You know, they basically, you know, the K-12 districts, I believe, are sort of in line to lose, you know, some technology or performance grants. Lansing, I think it's more than about $100,000, I believe. We'll have to watch and see really what happens there.
Okay. Tim Martin, a proposal that would expand Michigan's Education Achievement Authority has a lot of Democrats and school officials angry. They say the bill that would expand state oversight from a number of failing Detroit schools to the full bottom 5% of the state schools is way premature and a power grab. How much momentum does this EAA expansion measure have here at the end of March?
It's got some momentum. A version of that bill passed the House, I think it was last week. And what they've done is they've changed this proposal quite a bit from what was going on last year. It no longer would cover the entire bottom 5% for academically failing schools. It would now cover 50 of those schools.
Right.
So that's a significantly smaller proposal than it was a year ago.
Okay.
It's still got a lot of Democrats in traditional K-12 folks nervous. But they have made changes, made it smaller, given schools some more options to try and stay out of the Education Achievement Authority. They've given it a more momentum than it had last year. And I would expect that some kind of EAA legislation is going to pass this year.
Marketing Resource Group of Lansing does a lot of work with the GOP, and I have to ask you about their latest poll, which the Lansing State Journal wrote up in an editorial here this morning. It finds that what the LSJ says are pretty narrow margins in the race for Attorney General next year. It theorized a race between incumbent Bill Schuette and Gretchen Whitmer. It's got Schuette by 5% with a margin of error of 4%, and the State Journal suggests the GOP ought to be worried about this. John Lindstrom, what do you make of that?
Well, we're still talking about basically 18 months before the election, so I think the importance of these kinds of things are more for the professionals in the game who look at it and start saying, okay, who can the candidates be and what sort of things do we need to look at? If I remember correctly, there was also a fairly high part of that poll. It does, however, reflect the fact that Democrats are saying they're going to turn 2014 into a very, very significant year. Typically, non-presidential election years go better for the Republicans than they do for the Democrats, because this year, for 2014, the Democrats see it as their shot at getting back at things like right to work. It demonstrates that they're going to be trying to make this a bigger race, a tougher fight than whole overall, and the Republicans recognize that as well.
I'd like to go around and ask each of you what you felt was arguably an overlooked or underreported story from the month of March. Lindsey Van Hulley, what do you think?
I don't know that it's so much overlooked or underreported, but one thing that happened actually just this week that'll be really interesting for the city of Lansing is General Motors unveiled the new Cadillac CTS at the New York Auto Show. If you look at it, it is much different than the current version. You know, the motto is sort of longer and lower
leaner.
And leaner.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so it's built here at the Lansing Grand River plant, and when it starts this fall, it really is going to be sort of a 5 to 7 year really commitment from GM to the local plant here.
We do have a huge stake in the CTS.
Absolutely.
Not in Cadillac in general, but the CTS in particular.
Well, and after the success of the ATS, especially North American Car of the Year in Detroit in January, there's going to be a lot of expectation on the CTS to do just as well. So.
Right, and a new model's coming to LGR, too. We're waiting for the Camaro in 2015.
Mm-hmm.
Learning more about that. Tim Martin, overlooked and underreported in March.
Well, I think this theme has been reported in bits and pieces, but maybe not in one big chunk. But Governor Snyder and the legislature, they're still kind of feeling each other out in this particular term. The governor has not had a lot of success getting some of his top priorities done. He's still trying to come up with more than $1 billion for roads. Doesn't seem to be going anywhere. He wants to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. Doesn't seem to be going anywhere. And, of course, his proposals for a state-based and then a partnership on the health exchange has not come to fruition, and they might get stuck with a federal health exchange there. It just seems interesting to me that they don't seem to be on the same page on a lot of those things this year.
So it's going to be an interesting duration to the rest of the governor's term, it would seem. John Lindstrom, we got under a minute.
Real quickly, Attorney Richard McClellan took on the task of developing a concept of changing state education overall. This has been a big worry for the education community, in effect taking the governor's idea of basically blowing the whole thing open and coming up with a whole new concept where anyone can go to school anywhere that they want. He was supposed to deliver his proposal to the governor this month. He's held off because there's a great deal of concern about it still. He's ready to go. It's done. It's ready to go. But he also acknowledges that this is going to be a very if you were to attempt something like this, it's going to be incredibly significant. There's a lot of pieces to this that would have to be worked out.
We want to thank our Month in Review panel for the month of March, the Lansing State Journal's Lindsey Van Hulley, John Lindstrom of the Gongwer News Service, and Tim Martin for MLive. Thanks, one and all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up in the second half of Current State, are common insecticides a growing threat to mid-Michigan's bird populations? There are people who think so. We'll explore that. Also, the Free Press's Joe Rexroad on NCAA Sweet 16 action for Michigan State and some grassroots leaders on the neighborhood level here in Lansing. You're listening to Current State. This is 90.5 WKAR. Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. The American Bird Conservancy released a report last week calling for a ban on widely used insecticides suspected of damage to bird and aquatic populations. WKAR's Peter Worf spoke with MSU Assistant Professor of Zoology Dr. Pamela Rasmussen about the class of insecticides containing neonicotinoids.
The review article that the American Bird Conservancy did shows that there's a lot more reason to worry about toxicity to birds of this class of pesticides than has been acknowledged. And that, for example, a single coated grain of corn can kill a bird the size of a blue jay. And that's just a single grain of corn, but this is a persistent class of chemicals. They do degrade quickly in sunlight, but when they're not exposed to sunlight, then they're very persistent up to 3 years in the soil. And so, especially if people are not paying close attention to directions, then the levels can build up extremely rapidly to the point where it's hard to imagine why we still have birds in some places. And it's not just lethal levels that are of concern. It's sublethal or chronic levels that are of concern, because birds have to be in good condition. They can't be carrying a heavy pesticide load in order to reproduce, in order to survive. So a lethal dose is one thing, and a chronic dose is another thing. And the doses that are recommended are much higher than anything that can be considered safe. And it's not just to immediate bird survival, but it's also to food webs, because anytime you kill the food supply, you're going to kill you're going to have birds that die and can't reproduce.
How widespread are these chemicals, or how widely used are they? Where could we expect to find these?
Everywhere. They are the most widely used class of pesticides now. They have replaced earlier pesticides that were more lethal to mammals, but apparently these are as lethal to or more to certain other groups, such as aquatic invertebrates, certainly honeybees, possibly birds. What happened with the earlier class of pesticides was evolution of insecticide resistance. So these have been adopted very widely, and they're used worldwide. There are hundreds of different varieties, and they're in many, many chemicals that are readily available.
These were chemicals that were also linked in some way with honeybee decline. And I remember that 2 or 3 years ago, people looking around and saying, what's happened to all the bees?
I want to say I'm not an expert on honeybees, but it is widely known, and there are many studies, both scientific studies as well as agricultural reports, that honeybees are in a serious, serious state of decline. It's been termed colony collapse disorder. And basically, the honeybees become disoriented and desert their colonies if they don't die immediately. Mm-hmm. And it's now been shown that this seems to have a multitude of causes, but one of them, a very prominent one, seems to be this class of neonicotinoids, insecticides. Mm-hmm. And partly it's the fact that they're systemic, so the bees are getting the pesticide through the pollen that they're collecting. Mm-hmm. And partly it's because when treated seeds are applied, the dust blows off, and that is very, very lethal to the bees. So there's a whole bunch of different ways that bees are affected, and it's very important because bees do our pollination. Most of our non-cereal plants, anyway, are animal pollinated, and bees do most of that. And we don't get fruit crops or nut crops without bee pollination.
Dr. Rasmussen, could you comment on what this report might imply?
This is a very sobering report. We tend to assume that things have gotten better since there are tests and there are requirements for environmental impact assessments, et cetera, and pesticides can't just be automatically registered for use. But it seems that there's a great deal of cutting corners and underfunding and ignoring of results, et cetera, that goes into some of these decisions, and that the American Bird Conservancy's report makes for very sober reading. And to think that these chemicals are being used very, very widely all over the world in untold quantities is of great concern.
Assistant Professor of Zoology and Assistant Curator at the MSU Museum, Dr. Pamela Rasmussen, thank you very much for the conversation, both on the update on this new issue and the history as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
For Current State, this is Peter Whorf.
It's Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Tonight, number 3 seed Michigan State hopes to prevail over number 2 seed Duke in a Sweet 16 matchup. at Lucas Oil Field in Indianapolis. And the Free Press's Joe Rexrow joins us to talk about that. How are you, Joe?
Good, Mark. Very, very much looking forward to this game. Should be a great one.
What do you think this matchup boils down to?
Well, you know, I think it boils down to which team plays better collectively on the defensive end of the floor. There are a lot of good matchups, interesting matchups. You could go right down the list, and it's very close, position by position. And, you know, the coaches, obviously both great coaches. So it's a really good matchup in terms of team and program. But I just think whichever team does a better job, but for Michigan State, it's guarding the pick and roll, the ball screens, getting out on shooters, not letting Duke shooters get open shots, not allowing Duke's penetrators to get into the lane, you know, to collapse the defense. And then on the other side, you know, for Duke, it's really a big thing is not just defending, but also then boxing out and not letting Michigan State get a lot of offensive rebounds. Michigan State just killed Memphis last week with offensive rebounds, and I think Brandon Dawson's playing a lot better. Adrian Payne, Derek Nix. You know, Michigan State's a little bit bigger and more athletic than Duke.
Michigan State clearly would like to prevail on the boards just like they did against Memphis. They really owned that stat. If Dawson, Payne, and Nix step up again, that's huge, isn't it?
It is, and the thing is, it's kind of tough both ways. I guess the one matchup for both teams that's kind of a little bit of a mismatch in different ways for Michigan State, Brandon Dawson's going to have to guard Rashid Suleiman, a freshman, very quick guard, a good shooter, you know, and it's going to be tough for him to chase him around. On the flip side, can Suleiman keep Dawson off the board? You know, Dawson's much bigger and stronger, and so that is the one thing, you know, if you're looking at individuals, that will be very interesting to watch.
Krzyzewski says defensive rebounding specifically will be a key to the game. Do you agree?
Yeah, absolutely, because, you know, I mean, for Duke, not only to you know, get stops, get rebounds, but you know they want to run. Duke wants to run in this game, and if you're not, you know, doing a good job in the defensive glass, you're not going to be able to run. And Michigan State wants to run too, so I think the rebounding will be key. And I think you are going to see both teams run up and down the court a little bit, play some off-tempo basketball. I think it's going to be a very entertaining game.
And we learned yesterday, Appling will be wearing the brace, correct?
Yeah, unless something changes last minute, he will have that brace on tonight on the shoulder. Never has not played in a game with it ever. He has practiced all week, and I've been able to watch him twice practice with it, and I thought he looked pretty good. He shot actually really well with it, but you never know. It still restricts your movement a little bit, and he definitely has been trying to convince the trainers to let him take it off, but it looks like he's going to have to wear it, so it'll be interesting to see if that has any effect.
You made a case yesterday for MSU being in the same league overall as the Blue Devils. If you ran into somebody who disagreed with that, how would you try to persuade them?
You know, again, it's sort of same league, but, you know, 15 years behind. You know, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, if you talk about elite programs and you talk about programs that, you know, get more attention, you know, have a better chance of recruiting the best players, things like that. I mean, longevity is a big part of it. Michigan State has now done it for 15 years under Tom Izzo. You know, this is the 16th grade NCAA tournament. I mean, Duke really has been right up there since, you know, the mid-80s under Mike Krzyzewski. But if you look at the accomplishments of Tom Izzo, I mean, 6 Final Four of the national championship, you know, 11 Sweet 16s in 16 years and all that. I mean, you can go down the list and you can make the argument, certainly, that in the last 15 years, since Michigan State really took off in that 97-98 season, Michigan State's as good as anyone. The one thing that, of course, is only the one national championship, and that's what people would argue. But, you know, like, there are some other top programs out there that don't have any.
Before MSU tonight, it's Michigan and Kansas. Quickly break that one down for us.
Well, I think Michigan got so much confidence back last weekend, and that was huge for them. You know, the matchups were good for Michigan in terms of teams that wanted to play up-tempo. And, you know, in the Big Ten, the book on Michigan this year was slow the game down, be physical with them, don't let them get in transition, and their half-court offense is not good enough. And VCU and South Dakota State let Michigan run, and you saw how good they looked, especially Glenn Robinson Jr. and Mitch McGarry, those two freshmen, really benefited from the up-tempo game. But Kansas is going to bring it right back to what the Big Ten teams have done. Kansas is going to play that tough defense. They have a very good shot-blocking center in Jeff Withey. They have a very good defensive guard. So it'll be a less comfortable game for Michigan. Not the kind of game they like to play. Tougher matchup. But when you get the confidence you got last weekend, maybe that can still carry. I still think it'll be a very good game. I would favor Kansas slightly in it.
So in the end, who do you pick, Joe, MSU or Duke?
You know, I'm going to go with Michigan State. I think both teams at their very best, I think Michigan State is a little bit better than Duke. And some people would argue that and say Duke, you know, 21 without or with Ryan Kelly, who missed some of the season with a foot injury. They lost four games without him. Certainly Duke's better with him, but I still think Michigan State a little bit better in some of the matchups and overall a little bit more athleticism. So the question is, will Michigan State, you know, cut down on those mistakes and play smart basketball? And I have to think the focus is going to be there for this game. So I'm taking Michigan State in a close game.
Joe, we hope to talk to you Monday about our Elite Eight matchup. Have a good weekend.
Okay, thanks, Mark. You too.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. Colonial Village, Averill Woods, the East Side, North Town, in the city of Lansing, these are among well over a dozen separate neighborhood associations dedicated to improving the quality of life at the grassroots level. Now, volunteers willing to get involved are part of the lifeblood of these neighborhoods. Earlier this week, Current State learned about several Lansing residents who've stepped up recently to assume leadership positions in these groups, and we've invited a few of them in to talk about their particular challenges and the rewards of living in their neighborhoods and what triggered their desire to get involved. I'd like to welcome Lisa Bank, who is president of the Westside Commercial Association. Her group is mostly focused on reducing blight on the Saginaw Corridor on Lansing's west side. Welcome, Lisa.
Good morning.
Paul Johns is the new president of the Moores Park Neighborhood Association. Paul says he's seen an increase in crime recently and wants to bolster involvement in neighborhood watch programs. Hi, Paul.
Hello. Good morning.
And Joe Duras is the president of the Old Oakland Neighborhood. Joe wants to create a more cohesive neighborhood through cleanup and a community garden and more events. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Mark.
Let's go around the horn here and have each of you share your neighborhood's biggest challenge as you see it. Joe Duras, what about the Old Oakland neighborhood?
Well, in Old Oakland, Mark, you know, we have a pretty tight-knit community so far. We really kind of came out of a place where neighbors knew neighbors, and we wanted to just kind of improve things and, you know, bring down crime. I think it's always an issue in every neighborhood. Our neighborhood doesn't have a really high crime problem, but one of the biggest issues that's facing us right now is actually just an issue of property values. We're seeing property values fall, and they've been falling since, you know, around 2008 when kind of everything fell out. Jobs left the area, and then a lot of people left our neighborhoods. So one of the things that we're really trying to do is create cohesion in order to create a positive environment in the neighborhood that is desirable for people to move in. So that's kind of one of our biggest challenges is really dealing with those lower property values. You know, we have some other issues, issues of speed control, traffic control through our neighborhood, and also complete sidewalks initiatives. So we don't have all complete sidewalks in our neighborhood, and it's something that we're working on right now.
Complete streets.
Complete streets.
Is
yeah.
that right?
Yeah.
And explain where the Old Oakland neighborhood is.
Sure. So Old Oakland neighborhood is between Oakland and Willow. And between Stanley Streets and Kaywood Streets. And if for anybody that knows the area, it's where the Irish Pub and Fork in the Road are, just north of those two businesses on Oakland.
I was sorry to see in this morning State Journal that the Irish Pub is tonight's its last night in business.
Yep, it is its last night. So we're all kind of sad about that.
So the first landmark you mentioned in terms of getting to your neighborhood is unfortunately its swan song tonight.
Yeah, and it's a business that has really it's brought us together. We've met there. We've you know local musicians play there. So it's a loss for
that,
our community.
That can't be good.
No, it's not. It's
do you know? Is anybody expressing interest in the property is, do you know?
I don't know at this
okay.
point. Yeah.
Okay. Lisa Bank, what about the Saginaw Corridor? You're with the Westside Commercial Association.
That's absolutely right. And the Irish Pub is an anchor business for us, so it really is a tragedy. They have a long history in our community. And our corridor, it spans from Stanley Street, which is right around where the old GM plant was by the fork in the road, and it goes to Grand, which is by LCC. And so one of our biggest challenges right now is that we are working to revitalize the corridor, and we want to do this through neighborhood group collaboration, business collaboration efforts, and so we're trying to decrease the vacancy rate. And so one of our biggest challenges there is that we have these property values that Joe spoke of that we're dealing with. We have different landlords that don't take care of their property, and you know, we handle different types of code violations. And how can an investor come in and take over a property when really it just needs to go down to the ground and get rebuilt, but
it's really a they land can't afford. Use.
Yeah, it has a lot use. To do with land use and zoning and figuring out, you know, the chicken or the egg, who can come in first and take over this area, or who wants to come in and take over this area. And so we have our anchor businesses, and we're trying to really figure out kind of what we're doing with that. And then another big thing that we're dealing with along the lines of the Complete Streets Initiative is that we want to focus our area and make it something that is walkable, bikeable, that it is pedestrian friendly. We want people to feel like they can come from the neighborhoods, they can come from different areas of Lansing or thereabouts, and they can truly experience something that is similar to kind of a downtown feel. We want to have vibrant businesses that are surrounded by vibrant neighborhoods that all kind of feed into each other. And people never felt safe. They don't feel safe walking down Saginaw because it was three lanes of fast traffic. People wanted to get where they were going. There was nowhere to park. Nobody wanted to sort of encroach on that.
Sure. It favored motorists.
It really did. Yeah. And we took a big step with that, with working with the city and MDOT to get that bike lane in, because that was a catalyst. That was something to start this process. But that is something that we're working towards. We want people to feel like they can take their dogs out or walk with their families and get to this point of having a walkable, bikeable community.
That is a larger issue in the entire...
It really is.
And in townships, the neighbor Lansing. I mean, it's accessibility for people who are not in cars.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's something that we can start along our corridor, and we can work to try and improve that.
Paul Johns, tell us about Morris Park. What's your biggest challenge, you think, in your neighborhood?
Well, I always say that Morris Park is a great place to live. You know, it's been my catchphrase for the last 3 years, and I did speak a little bit to you about crime, but what I've noticed is in our neighborhood, what our biggest challenge seems to be is getting neighbors engaged with neighbors, trying to get them out to community events and beefing up the communications, cross communications between neighbors. I did speak to you a little bit about crime. Being the president of the neighborhood organization, I do hear about all the different crime activity in the neighborhood. So when I say there's been an increase in crime, I think that primarily Morris Park is a wonderful place to live. It's safe. We have great response from the police department when we have issues. So.
Is Morris Park?
Morris Park is between Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard to Washington, and then from the river to Mount Hope. That's our primary area. But we're trying to expand this year to include more homes, the area between Mount Hope and the train tracks that cross over MLK. So there's a train track that runs kind of diagonal between Washington and MLK. So we're trying to include more homes in our neighborhood. One of the things that Lisa was talking about that I found interesting, or her and I were talking about in the waiting room, is we have some, we have an older neighborhood. It's been around for a long time. It's got a lot of history here in Lansing area. And as I've taken over the neighborhood group, I've noticed that we've had some literature, some historic literature, some of the stuff's on what we used to call dittos. And so we're revamping, and what we're trying to also do in Morris Park is engage the neighbors with local businesses also. So today I'm going to be out canvassing the area, talking to different businesses in order to get them to contribute to this booklet. We have a Morris Park neighborhood handbook that we're trying to revamp, take it from the ditto era into the modern age.
Something you said really resonated with me. I get riled up at myself on a regular basis of how disconnected I can get with a lot of my neighbors. I mean, most of us know each other, okay? But there is, I mean, I think you could argue there just isn't enough regular contact. Are the residents in your neighborhood, Joe Duras, are they essentially connected or are they essentially disconnected?
You know, that's one of the things that we've worked a lot on. Even, you know, before our association has reestablished itself last year, we were kind of a defunct organization for a little while, and then we reestablished ourselves. But one of the big things that we wanted to do was to create a place where people could come together in mm-hmm. order to meet each other, to, you know, kind of interact and connect with each other. And that was why last year, one of our first actions as an association was to work with the garden project here in Lansing to create a community garden in a city park. So we worked with the city and we worked with the garden project as part of the Greater Lansing Food Bank, and we created a community garden. We had 22 households participating last year, and that's about 10% of our neighborhood, which is really great. I mean, it kind of spanned all the streets of our neighborhood. We had people participating, people
this
interacting.
This is growing
fresh
carrots,
vegetables.
Carrots, corn,
yep,
vegetables.
That's exactly
okay.
it.
Oh,
and,
absolutely.
And what it does is it creates that space, and it creates a place where people can go out and they can see other people from their neighborhood working. They can talk to them. Mm-hmm. They can participate. And then when you have those events that Paul was talking about, people are excited because it gives them something to celebrate.
You need almost a visual focal point for your neighborhood. But Lisa, a bank, that must be a challenge for you because you're talking about such a huge area.
Not necessarily. I mean, yes, it is. But we have these monthly business breakfasts. And it used to be that we would come up with some topic for that were relevant to small business owners. And then we would have them together and we'd talk about that topic. But honestly, we restructured it in the last couple of months, and what we do now is it's open to the community. It always was. But now we bring in people that are talking about some things that are relevant to things that are going on the West Side, and they talk about it. They have different programs, and we just kind of fill them in on what's going on in the corridor. They can ask questions, and it's a really great networking tool for the different business owners as well as the neighborhood surrounding, because they come and they find out what's going on with the construction, or they come in and they find out what's going on with the different businesses, or what's going on with this new bike program, or whatever. And it's a really great way for people to feel connected with each other.
And the community garden bit that she's talking about, that has been a wonderful program in our neighborhood, and it has brought a lot of residents out to meet each other.
What's the level of volunteer involvement in Old Oakland? Is it what, I mean, you alluded, Joe, to the fact that your group disbanded for a while. It was out of business for a little while.
And that had to do with the way that the neighborhood was kind of restructuring mm-hmm. itself as people moved out. So we had a lot of kind of flight from the neighborhood. Then younger, I think, people moved in. So we kind of have a real range of people, probably from, you know, early families to retired folks. And so, you know, with that kind of span, when we got this influx of younger family types, there was a real push to become more active and to become more engaged. And so, you know, what we've seen as a result of that is a higher rate of volunteerism, I think, in the community. And that's actually brought out some of our older, you know, either kind of at the end of their careers or more retired residents to really be engaged and take part in the garden and in the organization.
Okay. We want to continue this conversation. This has been so good. I want to thank Lisa Bank, president of the Westside Commercial Association, Paul Johns, the new president of the Moores Park Neighborhood Association, and Joe Duras, president of the Old Oakland Neighborhoods, all in Lansing. Thanks, one and all.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We are giving away another pair of tickets for tonight's 8 o'clock performance for the Beatles tribute band Rain at the Wharton Center. The first caller will receive a pair of tickets by calling 517-355-9527. Once again, 517-355-9527. Coming up next week on Current State, we'll speak with Congressman Dan Kildee. On Monday, he's got a program to revitalize America's cities, and you'll be the first to hear the results next week of the State of the State survey led by MSU economist Charlie Ballard right here on Current State. All that and more coming up. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Joel Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks to producer Emmanuel Berry, Aaron Young for engineering, and Gabby Saldivia for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR. Have a great weekend.
Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA. And by LSJ Media, offering digital marketing solutions to area businesses of all sizes, such as website development, email marketing, optimization, and more. Information at lsjmedia.com.